Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with more campuses erupting across the country as protests against Israel's war in Gaza intensify and spread, and speak with Wendy Perlman, a professor of political science and director of the Middle East and North Africa Studies Program at Northwestern University. Her books include Violence, Nonviolence, and the Palestinian National Movement, and Triadic Coercion, Israel's Targeting of States that Host Non-State Actors. She is a signatory to an open letter from the staff at Northwestern University urging productive conversations regarding students' rights to protest peacefully, and we'll discuss how the agreement between the students, faculty, and the administration at Northwestern has led to a de-escalation, serving as a possible model for other universities whose leaders have often made bad decisions that have led to escalation and confrontation. Then, with Trump fined $9,000 today for violating many gag orders and threatened with jail by the judge, we will explore in depth the chilling and disturbingly accurate analogies between the rise of Hitler in 1932 and the American political moment in 2024. 100 years ago, in 1924, Hitler's grandstanding in court, then being jailed as a martyr for the cause of making Germany great again, only boosted his popularity. Then he rose to power thanks to a divided gerontocracy on the left, weakened by a split with the far left, which allowed a deranged demagogue, supported by a one-third minority, but with the help of right-wing media barons and short-sighted plutocrats, to seize power and end democracy. Joining us is Timothy Ryback, who has written on history and politics for more than three decades. He is the author of Hitler's Private Library, a Washington Post best-selling book of the year, and The Last Survivor, a New York Times notable book. He is the co-founder and director of the Institute for Historical Justice and Reconciliation in The Hague, and his latest book just out is Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. And we'll discuss his article at the Los Angeles Times, Trump Turns His Trials into a Soapbox. Does he know he's channeling Hitler? And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Wendy Perlman, who's a professor of political science and director of the Middle East and North Africa Studies Program at Northwestern University. Her books include Violence, Nonviolence, and the Palestinian National Movement, and Triadic Coercion, Israel's Targeting of States that Host Non-State Actors. And she's a signatory to an open letter from the faculty at Northwestern University urging productive conversations regarding students' rights to protest peacefully. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendy Perlman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there have been protests at Northwestern now for several days, with pro-Palestinian protesters taking over the Deering Meadow, which is a large plot of green space at Northwestern University, calling for the university to divest from Israel. So set the scene for us, and then we'll talk about what you've managed to do and others at the university in terms of coming up with a kind of de-escalation program.
Yeah, so a group of students sort of launched an encampment on Thursday morning. It began with several dozen students and some tents with a plan to begin in the morning. They were immediately met with campus police, who wanted to shut this incipient encampment down, and they managed to withhold their effort from the police. Other allied faculty and staff also tried to zoom in to help them get the encampment off the ground, and they were able to establish tents, and then proceeded to grow during the course of the day with more tents, more people, flyers, flags, and by the end of Thursday had Hundreds of people from both on campus and the Chicago community came in solidarity and really helped establish a full encampment that then proceeded to grow on Friday and Saturday. Despite rain here in Chicago, students held their ground. They slept in tents and built almost an alternative and beautiful society. There was a kind of urban planning with people creating spaces to walk between the tents that I think numbered to 80 or 100 at their peak. There was a food tent in which people in the local community donated more free food than people could even eat to keep the students and the protesters fed, to the point that people gave the food back to local food pantries because there was so much solidarity shown to them. Someone built a stage with a microphone, so there was a robust programming daily with students organizing everything from musical performances, dance performances, poetry readings, teach-ins and lectures. There's a medical tent, crafts tent, and also built a sort of decision-making process and organized themselves with various demands that had been announced beforehand. And that proceeded Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, along with a negotiating process that I'd be happy to talk more about.
But let's talk about what happened on Sunday, though. There were protesters facing off the pro-Palestinian with pro-Israeli demonstrators, and it got heated at times, did it not?
I was there at that time, and it was quite heated and quite nasty. There were at that point there were hundreds of students in the camp. Well, maybe hundreds. My numbers and estimations of crowds is not my strong point. But a far smaller group of pro-Israeli protesters who had flags, and it was extremely heated. And some of this counter-protest, this pro-Israel protest, were frankly extremely, extremely nasty. We heard stories, not just heard stories. I know students who were pushed, who were shoved, who were spat upon, who faced racial slurs and epithets. They came under extreme abuse. And from what I saw, nearly all of the protesters, there's not the very large majority of the pro-Israel protesters, were not Northwestern students or even Northwestern affiliated. Most were people from outside who had come to protest and to frankly abuse our students. It was atrocious to see. Luckily, the university administration sort of intervened to try to get them to back away. Throughout, our students demonstrated remarkable discipline. There had been what was called marshal training prior to the encampment. So a network of people who wore yellow vests, who were trained in tactics of de-escalation, and wonderfully helped to organize the camp in the face of this counter protesters. People linked arms and were silent and held their ground. And as people got heated, the marshals would come to try to de-escalate and isolate. And it was incredibly peaceful and a real model of discipline and organization in the face of really, really ugly attacks.
So, Wendy Perlman, let's talk about the work that you and others have done to bring about some kind of de-escalation. And of course, when you look at the national picture, things are escalating today at Columbia University, where the protests in many ways started at Columbia. Students just seized a building. So it's escalating there. Across here in the state of California, all the Cal State campuses are roiling. Particularly Cal State Humboldt. So things are getting more contentious and in some cases more violent across the country. So what have you and your colleagues done to de-escalate at Northwestern?
Yeah, so I can't take any credit for this. I've been more of a spectator of watching students and others who are more involved in what became known as sort of a bargaining committee, and I was supporting them a bit more in the back scenes. But as this the encampment began on Thursday, essentially, the university leadership reached out to try to have a meeting with students. And students had been thinking beforehand that if it got to this point, that they would form some sort of a bargaining committee. And students got together in a circle and basically decided what should be their structure, and decided on, I believe it was either two or three undergraduates, I think three undergraduates, three graduate students, and two faculty members to serve as representatives of the encampment and the movement. I'm not quite sure the number of students, but this a small committee that had a sort of mandate that began meeting with the administration, and there were negotiating meetings for hours on Thursday, and then for hours and hours Friday, Saturday, sometimes into the wee hours of the night, with students then going back to their community, to into their base to sort of continue to build a mandate. And pushing and pushing and pushing the administration, and the administration also being quite receptive, and wanting to work with students. The administration could have brought in police. They could have militarized the situation. They could have suspended people. They could have arrested. They could have cleared down the encampment. But instead, and I salute them for this, listened, and I salute the movement and the people on the bargaining committee for staying committed to their goals of divestment and Palestine, and pushing as far as they could. And after days of negotiating and listening to each other, essentially an agreement was that the parameters of an agreement was reached that consisted of several elements. One is the university wanted the end of the encampment in the sense that they wanted tents to come down, but they in exchange for tents coming down, the university granted students a number of things. One, the right to have continue to have peaceful demonstrations on Deering Meadow every day until the end of classes on June 1st. They could be have one aid tent, but no other tents, but they could continue to use this space to continue to protest. So the university was granting and recognizing that right to free speech and free protest and free dissent, but moving it from an encampment to a different phase of dissent. The university also pledged to condemn and work against doxing, and other ways that students might be punished for their free speech, because this, of course, is a major safety and equity concern for our students. Most importantly, the university agreed to full disclosure on investments. Divestment, divestment, divestment is the main push of our student movement, as it has been on many campuses. Divestment is, of course, complicated. It doesn't practically and legally speaking can't happen in a day, but it's a process. And it was agreed upon that this process, the first door to the process, you can't have divestment from investments unless you know what those investments are. So full and complete disclosure is the first step to even having a conversation of divestment. And the university committed to disclosing its investments. Anyone in the Northwestern community can ask the university about its investments and holdings, and the university committed to respond within 30 days about what it is invested in. They also agreed to reignite what had been a previous body called the Advisory Committee on Investment Responsibility, that would have both representation from students and faculty and staff, to have more deliberation, more consultation, more transparency about the university finances, so that they are so that this can be the basis of knowledge, of openness, of transparency, in which this movement can continue to work to push for divestment. In addition, there were a few other things that were included on in on a, under the heading of inclusivity, that the university pledged to bring in two visiting Palestinian faculty members, faculty professors at risk, as well as provide full ride scholarship for five Palestinian undergraduates. They made major movement on creating a prayer space for Muslim students and a meeting space for MENA identifying students. This has been something that students have been pushing for years, and the university had finally agreed to do that, recognizing that these Arab, Muslim, Palestinian, and Middle Eastern students need more resources, need more support. An agreement was reached, and then it was taken back to the students in a process of democratic deliberation and consultation, creating a new steering committee of ultimately 15 members plus three other members from the bargaining committee. And the students talked into the wee hours of the night, Sunday to something like 4 or 5 in the morning on Monday, and voted and agreed to accept this agreement that was put forth by the administration, and it was announced on Monday.
And prior to that, on Sunday, you were involved, Wendy, with this open letter from 158 faculty members at Northwestern calling for this kind of procedure that just you described, right? So that was a part of it, wasn't it? The fact that the faculty weighed in.
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, our role, this was a student-led movement, led by student discipline, creativity, camaraderie, talent, sweat and tears. And our role as faculty was to continue to implore the administration not to react with force.
Which is what happened at Columbia, and we're bringing
Absolutely.
In the NYPD, and unfortunately here in Los Angeles, USC did the stupidest thing of all, which was cancel this wonderful valedictorian who didn't have an anti-Semitic bone in her body, and her instructor, who obviously saw her speech, is a scholar of the Holocaust. He's written about 10 books, so there's been some real mishandling. That's why I was interested in talking to you, to get an idea of how things could be handled better.
Yeah. So we have we started an open letter of faculty last week that was published in the school newspaper on Thursday at the same moment the encampment began. That was first addressed to the president and the provost, saying, don't ban protests. We will not stand for criminalization of protest on our campus. Please do not act with force. Let these students protest. And the protest began. And then this new letter on Sunday was directed to the chairman of the Board of Trustees and the life members of the trustees, appreciating that they had not until that point reacted with force, saying that we appreciated this responding to the student dissent with patience rather than haste, with listening rather than presumptions, and avoiding confrontation and force. We were proud that this was happening at Northwestern. We hope that this can be a historic model that can be an example to other administrations across the country. You don't have to respond with suspensions, arrests, law enforcement, and force. There is a path of listening, taking seriously students' concerns, finding a way that's not only good for the student movement, but actually good for the whole university. We should all have transparency on things like finances. University belongs to all of us, and people want to know what money comes in and what money goes out and why. This is not contrary to the health of a university. It upholds values of transparency, of openness, of debate, of deliberation, of discussion, of learning. This is what higher education stands for. There are ways to respond to these protests that take them seriously, allow students to work on the ground to create the better world they envision, and in no way compromises the health of the institution. It can only push forward what a university should be.
Well, Wendy Perlman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendy Perlman, who's a professor of political science and director of the Middle East and North Africa Studies program at Northwestern University. Her books include Violence, Nonviolence, and the Palestinian National Movement, and Triadic Coercion, Israel's Targeting of States That Host Non-State Actors. And she's a signatory to an open letter from the faculty at Northwestern University urging productive conversations regarding students' rights to protest peacefully. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the disturbingly accurate analogies between the rise of Hitler in 1932 and the American political moment in 2024. as Trump channels Hitler.
Whoa! Same tricks they used before. They're trying to divide us, but that'll only multiply us. Whoa! The same tricks they used before. They're trying to divide us, but that'll only multiply us. Separation, intimidation, brainwashing the new generation. They use violence, they are tyrants. They make laws and they expect silence.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Timothy Ryback, who has written on history and politics for more than three decades. He's the author of Hitler's Private Library, a Washington Post Best Book of the Year, and The Last Survivor, a New York Times Notable Book. He's the co-founder and director of the Institute for Historical Justice and Reconciliation in The Hague. And his latest book just out is Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Trump Turns His Trials into a Soapbox. Does he know he's channeling Hitler? Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Ryback.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Timothy. And I'd like to start with, I guess it's the foreword in your book, or it's just before the book. It's a quote from Dorothy Thompson.
Says it all.
Who happened to have been married to Sinclair Lewis and was one of the, I guess, the first American journalists to interview Hitler. And what she said is, this is what you have in the beginning of your book. When I walked into Adolf Hitler's room, I was convinced that I was meeting the future dictator of Germany. In something like 50 seconds, I was quite sure that I was not. It took just about that time to measure the startling insignificance of this man who has set the world agog. Now, I have to tell you, Timothy, I've talked to a lot of people who've met Donald Trump, and they've had a similar response. And if you think about, for example, Bertolt Brecht's play, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, that reduced Hitler down to a minor racketeer in the Chicago markets trying to take over the cauliflower concession. What is it about history where we don't profile the person, who he really is, as opposed to his activities in the case of Hitler? You know, something like 50 to 75 million people died as a result of this small man's psychosis.
Well, Ian, you know, I think that quote does say it all. And I guess it's part of, especially with Hitler, actually with anything, it's the historian's profession to explain how we got where we got. And what that does is, and what you need to do is to look at all the facts that bring us to the point where we ended up. And as you said, with Adolf Hitler, it's, you know, 50, 60 million dead. But when you explain that as a historian, it ends up lending the person and the events a sense of historical inevitability. And when that quote by Dorothy Thompson about the astonishing insignificance of this man, it actually, I decided to, in writing this book, I decided to put myself in the moment, you know, in the early 1930s, and to view things as they were viewed on a day-by-day development. And what you end up with is, rather than historical inevitability, you just see political contingency and how much events of the moment shaped how we ended up where we ended up. So,
well, when you talk about events of the moment, nothing could be more uncanny in the comparisons with what's just happened today in the New York court, where the judge warned Trump that if he disrupts the court anymore and violates his gag order, he will go to prison, and he fined him $9,000. When Adolf Hitler was convicted of treason on April 1st in 1924, he, as you point out, discovered that courtrooms can be an excellent soapbox for political grandstanding, which he did. And he also said defiantly to the judge, "You can declare us guilty 1,000 times, but the eternal court of history will tear up the indictment and conviction with a smile and will acquit us." So just tell me what you think about those kind of analogies.
Well, I think the analogy there, I mean, Adolf Hitler saying this in a courtroom in the spring of 1924, as you say, he's just been convicted of treason. What you sense there, and if you're looking for comparisons, is just this fierce, blind determination to, as Hitler said, you know, to destroy democracy through democratic processes. But Hitler would just take any reality and warp it to his vision of what he wanted. I advance a couple of years there. He ran against Hindenburg for president in the spring of 1932. He loses by 6 million votes. He claims voter fraud and irregularities by state officials, and he goes to court to have the election results overturned. That particular judge threw him out on his ear and, you know, just said, "I'm sorry, margin of 6 million votes, you know, there is no, even if there are some discrepancies, it's too large a margin for error." But it was on Hitler's part, just this blind determination to see it through and just ignoring any realities along the way.
Well, but isn't that what Trump did after he lost in 2020? It was through sheer willpower. He projected this alternative reality that he won, that Biden lost, and started the Stop the Steal movement. And now it's become a core belief amongst Republican voters, the majority of them. So, you know, Hitler may be a small man, but he had an enormous willpower, and Trump equally seems to have this amazing willpower, even though he is basically a weak strong man.
Yeah, well, Ian, I taught a course in Weimar and Nazi culture 30 years ago, and at the time, I used the United States, you know, Weimar was there, it was at 13 years, so it's, you know, just over a half a generation. And, you know, one could understand the failure of the Weimar Republic on the fact that there'd been less than a half a generation of people, you know, inculcated with democratic values. At the time, you're talking about the United States, 200 plus years, 10 generations of Americans imbued in democratic processes and values. And I used to say to my students, you know, look, you know, Weimar had a lot of faults, but one of it was simply not having had enough time and experience with democracy. Now we begin to question this. And when my motivation for writing the book, I started a couple of years ago sensing a lot of the resonances with Weimar at the time, but I didn't want to write a polemic. I also didn't want to draw false analogies. What I decided to do was, but there, nevertheless, there were these resonances. And so I decided to try to forget everything I knew about Hitler's rise to power. And I simply started reading the daily newspapers, reading diary entries, and basically following day by day events as they unfolded, basically from the perspective of the average German at the time. What ended up astonishing me were the resonances and the parallels, the courtroom appearances, the national rallies, the haranguing, the divisiveness, the fomenting of anger and rage, and frankly, some of the events were were rather startling. Hitler famously said, if he came to power, and this is clearly before Trump said it, was, when I come to power, heads will roll. In advance of one of the elections, this was in the November 32 election, Hitler told his people to be there, and he said, verbatim, es wird wild werden, which is basically, be there, it's going to be wild. And then you add to that, as you say, this toxic chemistry of courtrooms where every time Hitler appeared in court, he loved it because, A, he used it for grandstanding, and he actually, you know, his poll ratings increased. So there are uncanny parallels. There are very unsettling parallels to this. I guess what I would add is, and this is to quote a great German historian of the Weimar period, who said that, and this meaning, I'm not going to blame it all on Adolf Hitler, and I'm not going to, one can't blame it all on Donald Trump. Democracy are people voting. And this historian once said that the Weimar Republic died twice. It was murdered and it committed suicide. You know, the act of murder is very clear. Hitler was out to destroy the Weimar Republic, and he did. An act of state suicide by a constitutional republic with all the protections of, you know, free speech, due process, public referendum, it requires people also being willing to vote for this person, because you can have, Hitler began as a fringe fanatic. I mean, he had a couple of hundred followers on the Bavarian beer hall scene. It wasn't until his trial in 1924, for treason, the beer hall putsch trial, that he was, catapulted onto the national stage, and he even started making international headlines. But it took, in a democracy, it also took first thousands and then tens of thousands and ultimately millions of Germans being willing to vote for him.
Well, it helped a lot, didn't it, to have this media magnate, Alfred Hugenberg, who privately hated Hitler but went along with him because he hated the communists more and the social democrats more. I mean, the echoes of Rupert Murdoch and Lachlan Murdoch are just inescapable. You know, at this point, you don't even know whether the Murdochs have lost control of Fox News, but yeah. They are, the kind of Pravda of the Republican Party.
Well, Hugenberg's a good person to mention. Yeah, he was a media magnate. He controlled basically 1,600 newspapers across the country, in particular in heartland Germany, the local newspapers. Hugenberg, like Hitler, hated democracy, the Weimar Republic, and he wanted it destroyed, but he took a very different approach. Hitler at first tried to launch a putsch, which failed. He then set about using the legislative processes and the legal system to destroy democracy through democratic process. Hugenberg had a very different idea, and he called it Katastrophenpolitik, which is the politics of catastrophe. And what he did, he used his newspaper empire to spread, first of all, fake news, just outright lies, using freedom of speech. One of them, everyone was against the Treaty of Versailles. As we know, the Treaty of Versailles restricted the size of the German army to 100,000, burdened it with the guilt of the, you know, the entire war guilt, meaning all of the First World War was the responsibility and the guilt of the Germans, and most importantly, reparation payments. And, you know, what Hugenberg's press started putting out there was that the German government, in order to in order to meet its debts, was taking German teenagers and selling them into slavery abroad to the Allies to serve its debt. It was outrageous. It's a complete lie. But when people are reading this in the newspaper, he then introduced legislation, which was backed by Adolf Hitler, that said it was called the Liberty Law. And it had a number of provisions, but basically abrogating the Treaty of Versailles, but adding to it that the signatories to the Treaty of Versailles should be executed for treason against the German people, and that any government official who was implementing the provisions of the Treaty of Versailles should be put to death. This was part of his Katastrophenpolitik, was you had to be on one side of this issue or not. And basically what you saw with the Germans, this was Hugenberg's intention, through this outrageous legislation, through a lot of this fake news, basically polarized the German voters and the German public. And Hugenberg himself wanted to do this. He wanted to get it into the families and into the homes, into neighborhoods, where you had to be on one side or the other of these incredibly divisive issues. And he really did, through this process, fake news, we can call it, really hollowed out the center, because what he knew was that democracy relied on consensus, and that if he could hollow out the center and polarize the society, he would weaken the basis for democratic process.
And he ended up, of course, in Hitler's first cabinet. And after the war, he escaped the Nuremberg trials. So
Ian, what he also said on there was at that time, Hitler had the largest party, the largest number of seats in the Reichstag. But it was not a majority. They had basically 33% at the time. Hugenberg had 40 seats. He had the capacity to make or break Hitler. And the two of them had a very problematic relationship. Their only shared goal was to destroy democracy. Hugenberg ended up giving his 40 votes to Hitler, which allowed Hitler to be appointed chancellor. The day after Hitler was appointed chancellor, Hitler told an associate, Hugenberg told an associate, "I just made the biggest mistake of my life." So Hugenberg realized, right? And he was one of these, you know, I'm a historian, so I'm not going to talk about Republicans and Democrats and Biden and Trump. But what I will say is there were these enablers who, for their own ulterior motives, were brought into Hitler's orbit, somehow thinking that they could, A, keep him under control or outwit him. And, the rest is history, as they say.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we're back in a moment continuing the conversation with Timothy Ryback.
We're gonna tear Hitler down. We're gonna tear Hitler down. We're gonna tear Hitler down someday. We're gonna bring him to the ground. We're gonna bring him to the ground. We're gonna bring him to the ground someday.
Hello. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with Timothy Rybak, who's written on history and politics for more than three decades. He's the author of Hitler's Private Library, a Washington Post Best Book of the Year, and The Last Survivor, a New York Times notable book. He's the co-founder and director of the Institute for Historical Justice and Reconciliation in The Hague. And his latest book just out is Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Trump Turns His Trials into a Soapbox. Does he know he's channeling Hitler? And your new book, Timothy Rybak, Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power, is basically about the single year of 1932. And it chronicles that year in incredible detail on almost a weekly or daily basis, sometime on an hourly basis. And you see how a functioning yet flawed democracy in Germany handed over absolute power to someone who never won an election, never claimed, never got a majority, and who the entire conservative political establishment regarded as a total clown and a backed up by violent followers, like the kind of people that stormed the Capitol on January the 6th. And what's interesting about that analogy is that the University of Chicago did an analysis of the kind of people that were in the January 6th crowd. And although we saw the guy with the horns and some of the sort of crazy right-wing rednecks, most of those people were kind of small businessmen, and that was the makeup of Hitler's coalition. Historians, of course, have focused on the Weimar Republic's hyperinflation, but that was well over by 1932. And the people that voted for Hitler were, you know, what, country folk, burghers, small businessmen, rural Protestant voters. Tell us about the real coalition that voted for him.
Well, this is, Ian, you make a really important point here, is that inflation, this disastrous inflation, was over. The German economy was gradually recovering at that point. And what one doesn't realize is how fragile Hitler was. As you said, I track things on a day-by-day basis, sometimes hour by hour. What you begin to see actually was how fragile Hitler's position was at that point. He had this coalition of people. He had, you know, he had a base. His core group of supporters was probably around 19 or 20%. After the crash of 1929, He had 12 seats in the Reichstag, in the legislature at the time. The crash of 1929 increased his number tenfold. And then there was an election in July of 1932, where he doubled that again. And this is, you know, your question about who was voting for him. What he actually did by that took him up to 37%, which was the highest percentage the Nazis ever got in a free and open election. Hitler had made a lot of promises in the lead up to that. He had promised to enter into a coalition government. He had made a lot of other public concessions, you might say, that allowed people to say, hey, let's give this guy a go. So he did bleed votes from various parties, especially the centrist parties, that allowed Hitler to aggregate this 37%. What happened, though, is when he didn't make good on these promises, there was another election in November. Hitler actually lost 2 million votes. They began peeling off. They went to the communists. These were people, these were basically, working class people who were looking for an answer on the far right. When that didn't work, they peeled off to the far left. Another group, another million, went into Hugenberg's fold, who was another, it was a centrist, it was a right-wing conservative movement, but not as extremist or radical as Hitler's. So you had, by November of 32, you actually, Hitler's movement, A, had lost 2 million votes, of 2 million voters. He started hemorrhaging membership. He'd also run a number of very expensive elections, and they were, by one estimate, 90 million Reichsmarks in debt, which is hundreds of millions of dollars. The Nazi Party, by December of 32, was essentially bankrupt politically, financially, and even ideologically. There were fissures in Hitler's movement itself. So when this final move to come to power was really a last-minute gasp. Had that not happened, the German economy was stabilizing, and Hitler, I think that would have been the end. This was his one chance. Now, if you want to look at contemporary America, contemporary politics, Donald Trump has November coming up. If he doesn't make it this time, sorry, look at how old he's going to be in another 4 years. I think the dynamics will have changed again. So if we want to look at historical precedents, I think you can find, I think it's interesting to look at this particular moment in time, both for Hitler, but also for Trump.
Well, but you point out another analogy, and that is that the opposition, the Social Democratic Party and its leadership, had become a gerontocracy, out of touch with the generations below. And you also mentioned the communists. The communists had previously made alliances with the Social Democrats, but by 1932, under Stalin's orders, they began to depict the Social Democrats as being as great a threat to the working class as Hitler. And there again, you have analogies with Cornel West and Jill Stein here on the far left, basically saying there's no difference between Biden and Trump.
Absolutely, Ian. One of the lost opportunities, and I mean, historians do recognize this, was that had the Social Democrats and the communists been able to enter into a coalition, and even I think may have been able to pull in some centrist left movements there, would have had the 51% majority to make things happen. As it was, because of this fractured political situation, the self-serving interests of the various parties, Hitler, with 37% when he had it, even with this, was the largest political movement in the country. And Hitler's math on this was amazing, because what he argued was that 37% was 75% of 51%. So he had the majority of a simple majority, and therefore should be given power. And in fact, he knew how democracies functioned extremely well, because he leveraged that in the Reichstag, in the legislature, to paralyze practically every legislative process.
Well, let's talk a little, though, about the another analogy, the respectable conservatives like Mitch McConnell and Bill Barr, who oppose Trump but say they're going to vote for him. General Kurt von Schleicher, of course, epitomized that group back then in 1932, and he went along with Hitler on the basis that he thought that his game plan was to have the brown shirts, Hitler's and the SA's crowd, crush the left and the communist, and then have the regular German army crush the brown shirts. So that was the game plan. Fortunately, here in the United States, it looks like the General Milley's and Mattis's were the only adults in the room, and they've been able to restrain Trump. I don't see that analogy working here in the United States, although Trump has all of these right-wing militias behind him. So how do you see that analogy?
Well, I do think the conservative class of politicians willing to accommodate a demagogue because it serves a particular interest, their own partisan interest, but more importantly, that once he's in power, they can control him. I think those parallels are very clear. There's the operative phrase at that time was soup. You never eat soup as hot as it's cooked. Von Papen, who is basically the man who facilitated Hitler's chancellorship, with him serving as vice chancellor, basically said that once we get Hitler, we'll get Hitler into a corner, we'll box him in the cabinet till he squeaks. And they just thought that once they got him in there, and keep in mind, you know, Hitler only had the Nazis only had three seats on the cabinet, but Hitler was able to exploit things in ways and outmaneuver people that, you know, within a very short time had established himself as a dictator.
Right. Well, that's what Goebbels said, isn't it? The big joke on democracy is that it gives its mortal enemies the tools to its own destruction. Nobody could have said it better than Goebbels, right?
That's right. That's right, Ian. And the Nazis used every tool. They used the courts. They used the electoral process. They used freedom of speech. They used freedom of assembly. Every tool available to them. I think and this is where, you know, I talk about Weimar dying twice, you know, the murder and the suicide. I think the one tool that democracy had to counter all of that was the vote and the public referendum. And you don't know what you've lost until it's gone. I think if anything, the Germans did not no German would have voted for what they ended up with. Well, actually, maybe Hitler's core, his base would have, but the vast majority of Germans would not have voted for what the country ended up looking like in 1945.
Right. They wouldn't necessarily have voted for the death camps, but Donald Trump is talking about creating concentration camps. So just in closing, though, here, let's talk briefly about the role of the press. You profile the New York Times, Frederick Birchall, basically doing what sort of a lot of MSNBC does. It makes fun of Hitler as like he's a joke and never going to go anywhere to some extent. MSNBC does that about Trump by pointing out what a joke he is, but he's not a joke. Neither was Hitler.
Yeah, and you know, and that's a very important point. And that's why when I wrote the book, as I said, I did it without any hindsight, day by day. There is, and some of the cartoons that appeared in the press are really hilarious. I mean, and they made just mocking Hitler, calling him out on some of the really absurd things, some of the outrageous things, but also getting it completely wrong. There's a week before Hitler's appointed chancellor, this cartoon appears called The New Hamlet, Der Neue Hamlet, and it shows Hitler standing in the graveyard of his political movement, meaning that all the headstones are broken swastikas, and he's standing there looking at his own head, and basically saying, this man is mad, and he's also washed up. And a week later, he's chancellor. So I do think when you talk about the role of the press, I think there's, because we have these echo chambers and those existed in Weimar, people are reporting the stories that their readers want to hear, but losing any sight of what the realities are. But also going back to what you said initially, the quote from Dorothy Thompson, one of the smartest, journalists of the era, going into Hitler's office and meeting him, and within a minute or just so, saying, who is this guy? He's not going to go anywhere.
Right. Well, again, you get back to the difference between the person and what the person does. I guess isn't that one of the flaws of history? We judge tyrants by the scope of their activities rather than what they were and who they were as human beings.
Well, and in the case of Hitler, his enablers, mm-hmm. these, as you said, these conservatives who around him, who were making this possible, but ultimately at the end of the day, it's the voters, who voted for him. He never got more than 37%. There's a difference between Trump and if you're looking for comparisons and contrast, Trump has done better with the electorate than Adolf Hitler ever did.
Right, but the analogy that I'm trying to come up with, Timothy, is that if you talk to people that were actually in the Oval Office with Trump, who saw him working as president, up close and personal, they portray this complete idiot, out of control, stupid, ignorant, absolute amateur, and a sadist and a fool. I mean, I can go on with the adjectives forever about this man. And yet his people that vote for him see a completely different person. And that's what Dorothy Thompson saw in Hitler, who he really was. But his followers, you just have to look at Leni Riefenstahl's film to see the adoration that they had. And the same thing with Trump rallies.
Ian, you've said it better than I can. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Timothy, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was good talking.
Likewise. And I've been speaking with Timothy Ryback, who has written on history and politics for more than three decades. He's the author of Hitler's Private Library, a Washington Post Best Book of the Year, and The Last Survivor, a New York Times notable book. He's the co-founder and director of the Institute for Historical Justice and Reconciliation in The Hague, and his latest book just out is Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Trump Turns His Trials into a Soapbox. Does he know he's channeling Hitler? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.